Du lytter til Enneagrammet Next Level Podcast med Flemming Christensen. Og den her episode har tidligere været bragt i Enneagram Insights podcast. De refererer til en konference et par få steder, som blev afholdt i Egypten i januar 2024. Tjek gerne show notes, hvis du vil med på næste begynderkursus i Enneagrammet. Her får du viden om alle typerne, og det er en rigtig god start til din vej til at bruge Enneagrammet i dit liv.
Welcome everybody to this interview with Russ Hodson. I'm so excited that we have this hour together, Russ, and very welcome in this studio.
Well, thank you, Fleming. It's lovely to be here and have this opportunity to talk with you and with the people who are watching and listening to us.
Yeah. For people not so familiar with or how you get started in all this, how was the early days of the Enneagram for you?
Well, thank you, Fleming. Well, it was quite a journey. You know, I didn't get into it all at once. I don't think many people do. Maybe we read a book and it impacts us. I read Ouspensky's book, In Search of the Miraculous, in the 1970s. I was a young guy. I was, you know, still a teenager, actually. And it blew my mind. It was amazing and explained many things. I had been interested in science. I had been interested in spirituality. And was there any way this could all work out? And the way that it was explained in that book, where Ouspensky was essentially showing the world who Gurdjieff was and what his teachings were. And that book introduced the Enneagram symbol. So after a couple of years, I found and joined the real Gurdjieff work. And I did that for many years. But it's interesting because in the Gurdjieff work, they don't use the 9 Enneagram types. It's not part of it. Gurdjieff didn't teach that either. And anyone who says that he did are misinformed. It was, you know, my teacher was the woman who he put in charge of the work when he died. And she lived with him and worked with him for, you know, decades. So I have one degree of separation from Gurdjieff. So they just didn't have that. And I was learning about presence, about the centers, about inner work, about defense mechanisms, things like that. But it was in 1987, I read Don Richard Riso's book, Personality Types. Now, there was one Enneagram book that came out before that was written by B. Singh O'Leary and Nagasek, and it was aimed at a particularly Roman Catholic audience. But I wasn't part of that crowd, so I didn't see that book or know about it. But Don's was the first general book for the general public, and it kind of kicked off the whole field, really. And Helen Palmer's book came out about a year later, and I was very impacted by his book, and I found out he lived near me, so I went and arranged to talk with him. It was quite challenging for us to get together, but we did. There were no cell phones back in those days. And he got interested in my background in the Gurdjieff work, and I got interested in the ideas and theories he was forming about the Enneagram typology. And we resolved to try to bring a serious and deeper understanding of the Enneagram. And so we were there in those early days. I have to tell you, though, back then there were no internet. There very few people knew about this. And we were in the beginning of the creation of the whole field of it. And it's still amazing to me, you know, when you see all these podcasts and things, and some of them are good, some of them not as good, but people doing their best. But how much what is thought of as just the general Enneagram came from the work of Don Riso and me, came from Helen Palmer, came from Claudio Naranjo. There was a small number of us creating this field back in those days.
Yeah.
Catherine Chernick, there were a few of us that were, and little did we know, we wanted it to become popular. We wanted people to know about it. And every year we'd think, well, this year maybe it's going to get more known, but it really is now.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that goal got accomplished.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Do you think something is sort of lost in translation from, you know, the work of Gurdjieff into how we use the Enneagram today? Or is there a lineage that is very clear that this goes back, or how do you see it?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think inevitably, you know, when people learn about this, the first thing we learn about are these Enneagram types and which one are you? But we don't necessarily get trained in how you figure that out. And we don't necessarily get trained in what you do once you correctly identify your dominant type. I'm always telling people to remember you are not a type, but you have one. What we are is more interesting, more profound than just a description of traits. But those descriptions of traits tell us something important about ourselves. So I would say that the purpose of it is what gets blurred sometimes. And people have varying degrees of understanding of that. But for me, and as I learned it through the Gurdjieff work and in the work that Don Riso and I developed, and really Claudio would have agreed with us, and you know, some of my colleagues now, Uranio and Beatrice, you know, they would agree with this too. The Enneagram is a tool for the cultivation of presence and learning what it means to be present in my body, present in my heart, present in my mind. Not just going around typing other people and describing things. Of course, when you learn this, that's going to be interesting. And you're going to want to figure out what are the patterns of the people around you or famous people you admire or famous people you don't like. But that's not the ultimate purpose. So I just always hope that some individuals will get interested in the deeper part of it, the original sense of it. And I also think that it's important that some of us do the work of, how shall I say, creating a landing pad so that those who get interested in it and figure out there's a deeper side to it have a place to go. I feel a little responsible for that because I'm more or less the last one left from the first generation. A lot of people have passed on. They're not in the world anymore. And others have retired, you know, Helen Palmer retired and Maria Beesing retired, and a lot of people are not involved anymore or they're gone. But I'm still involved and I'm not gone yet. So I just want to make sure that there's some people in the world who understand the deeper side of it.
I started studying with you in 2001. And in the beginning, you had this answer to all my questions. It's all about presence. And I was kind of getting a little annoyed, like, hello, you cannot use that answer for whatever I'm asking. But, you know, decades after, I see, that there might be something about it. But how does the Enneagram actually point towards presence?
Mm-hmm. I was talking with a mutual friend of ours recently. And I was speaking in a small group. And one thing that came to me is that presence or mindfulness doesn't really motivate people because A, we don't know what it is. And B, it doesn't sound like something we're after, right? What's the advantage? But the thing is, when we are present, we start to experience the qualities that we human beings most love and most want to know about ourselves. We experience empowerment. We experience more love. We experience kindness. We experience more brilliant intelligence. We experience, it brings out the best in us. And whatever it is that is given to us to be and to share liberates those qualities. So at first, I think most of us get motivated. And through the Enneagram, we learn, we get an image, not just of our crummy personality issues, but if we understand it correctly, we understand what the essence of our Enneagram point is. We know, for example, if we're an eight, what that aliveness and empowerment and energy is, and that's part of being present. And that's what I want as an eight. You know, as a two, I find out the real source of heart connection. I'm never going to get it the way I usually do it. But there is a way to know and feel that beautiful, sweet heart connection. So each type has inside it something that all human beings wish to be and share and to know. So that becomes the motivation. When you know that, it's not so difficult to look at how you've screwed it up. It's not so difficult to see how your ego distorts that, because you know the real thing. So there's hope, right? You know what's true about you, and you're now just clearing the veils, right? Instead of thinking that the veils are all that you are. So there's a process there of both seeing what's true and wonderful about us, but also seeing, yeah, and that's not how I'm living, because I've still got these patterns that dominate my attention and my experience most of the time.
How do you think your own work with the Enneagram have impacted the way you teach or relate to people, live your life?
Yeah, well, you personally, I'm an Enneagram 5. That's my dominant pattern. And I was always quite clever. intelligence doesn't belong to 5. All 9 types can be very intelligent. But I was just very identified with my mind and thinking things out and figuring things out. I was quite good at it. But Don Riso, who was a 4, told me when I was very first working with him back around 1991, I think, he said, you know, you are a brilliant teacher. You're very clear. He says, but you'll become a great teacher when your students can feel your care for them, your love for them, that your wish to help them. And I thought that was very interesting at the time, but oh boy, was he right. And so for me, it's been a journey of allowing myself to feel more contact with people, to take in the love of others, to be generous with my heart and my time and share what's going on with me. As a 5, I was very, very, very private. And I didn't share much. You know, if I shared with you, it meant I really liked you. You know, but, you know, most people, no, they're not going to. I'll tell them all sorts of information about this and that, but not about me. No, you can't know me. But, you know, that has changed. And now when I'm teaching, I'm not just there telling my story. That will be boring. But I am sharing whatever about my story I think might be helpful to the people who are studying with me. A place for us to relate and for students to go, wow, he went through that. Maybe I could go through that too. You know, as a kind of encouragement. So I think that I just have also learned to be nicer to myself. That was a big one. I'm very austere, don't need comfort, don't need reassurance, don't need love. I don't need much was my kind of 5 motto. But actually, it's very nice to curl up on the couch and listen to some nice music or let somebody tell me that I've helped them or receive tenderness and things like that. I was not very good at that. And now, you know, being nice to myself, I think that might be true for all of the types. I think none of us are particularly good at being nice to ourselves. Indulging ourselves is not being nice to ourselves. We indulge ourselves because we're usually not being nice to ourselves. So it's like a compensation.
Yeah. Don, and you also manifested the book, The Wisdom of the Enneagram, that is probably the book sold most copies. And I think it's from 99 back. Yeah. It's a manifest. It's a, that was the book that kind of put me in the direction of you and Don. And I know it's translated into Danish, and I know that this is what people kind of give to each other when they say, oh, stop talking about numbers. Okay, then read the book. So it's kind of the thing. But it's decades ago. So some of that is still very, very true and precise. But if you should update a chapter or something in that book, Or will there be something that you would like to update, or is it as it should be?
Well, I think whenever a person writes a book, we're going to end up noticing things. Oh, that should have been more like that. Oh, I wish I said that. Oh, that isn't quite it. You can pick it apart endlessly. The best a book can be is your best understanding at a particular point in time. That's what I understood in 1999. And I will say there isn't much in that book that I would change. Not much. I think it holds up very well, is still very popular, is still kind of, you know, even people who were competitors with me said, that's really a good book. So, you know, we worked very hard on it. I have updated it in the sense I've done further work. I made an audiobook with Sounds True called The Enneagram 9 Gateways to Presence, since we're talking about presence. And all my friends who've actually got it have told me that it was amazing. And it is an update. It is what I've learned since I wrote Wisdom of the Enneagram. But a lot of people don't seem to know about it. It's on Audible, too, by the way. But I think I just continue to try to find ways to both take people deeper, but also to communicate about it in a way that people can receive it. So I'm working right now with our mutual friend, Catherine Bell, on a new book that will be out in probably a couple of years on the Enneagram and creativity. And it isn't about, here's what a type 4's creativity is, here's a type 5's creativity, here's a type 3's creativity. It's not that. It's about what each type pattern teaches us about the creative process. So it's a book on how to be more creative, but using the Enneagram as a tool to open up our creativity. So we got a publisher, and that book is coming out. But again, it was in service. I realized that, you know, a lot of people, especially a lot of young people, are a little suspicious of anything that sounds like religion. I mean, some people, that's their way. I mean, there are many Christians and Muslims and Jews and Buddhists, and this is how they came to it. And fabulous. And we can talk about it that way. But there's a big number of people out there that are suspicious of those things. Certainly there in Denmark, I know it's true. So I thought, you know, creativity is something everybody likes, everybody enjoys, everybody cares about it. But it turns out that the place that creativity comes from is the same place that the inner work traditions are pointing to. So what will help you get in touch with that will also open up your freedom to create. So we thought, you know, I don't think anybody's written a book about that before. You know, there are some great books on creativity. I love Julia Cameron's book, for example. And Rick Rubin recently wrote a great book about creativity. But using the Enneagram as a tool, instead of just a description of types, is something I'm interested in. And I got that because I have this earlier understanding of it from before it was just a typology.
That actually leads into the topic that you're presenting at the conference in Cairo in January. The title is Lessons from the Ancient World. And maybe creativity or that force or that element of life or human being is what could be found in the ancient world. Or question mark, exclamation mark. Do you see a lineage to that, or creativity, spirituality, the lineage of, or, well, the very long lineage of the Enneagram?
Sure. You know, well, I think I don't go so far as to say that there's some singular lineage of the Enneagram going back to the ancient world. Enneagram, modern Enneagram is woven from a variety of threads. And you're not going to go back to ancient Egypt and find the Enneagram symbol, but you'll find ideas that are relevant. They're philosophical frameworks or perspectives that impact what we're talking about. But I think the main reason I got interested in this is that as you go further back in time, human beings seem to have a very different view of the world. And I don't mean that they were just more superstitious. I mean, they experienced the world differently. You go back as far as Rome, and we can kind of understand what the Romans were like. They're not that different from us some ways, but we can kind of relate to the world of ancient Rome. You can go back to Greece or ancient Persia, and it's a little getting a little stranger, a little more different. but we could still kind of relate to them. But you go back to the Egyptians, you go back to Mesopotamia, you go back to really ancient India or China. Obviously, people had very different values than we have now. And they had a different way of experiencing themselves and their role in the universe than we do now. And I was just always baffled. And Egypt is helpful because it's so well preserved. But you can go back and look at the view of the ancient Egyptians and start to understand a little bit of how they saw things. And I think it fills in some missing pieces of our modern experience. I don't think we're going to become ancient Egyptians. I don't think that's possible. Probably, I don't think we could if we wanted to. However, their way of looking at life, at reality, at the what humanity is here for, they have some clues for us that I think could be very helpful in our journey into our future now as we face the many, many problems that we face. So, you know, some clues from the past. One thing I tell my students is, you know, they might say, oh, well, you know, but Egypt fell, so how great could they be? Yeah, they fell, but they lasted. Their civilization lasted thousands of years, not hundreds, thousands of years. What of our countries have been anything like that? None. So, you know, you start to have respect. They obviously had something that was working. And so why not learn from them? We don't want to, as I said, we don't want to copy them. And maybe there's some ways they were that we wouldn't want, but there are some things that would, I think, be helpful. And that's really what I'll be talking about in that and how those ideas relate to things we learn in the Enneagram.
And you have been doing a lot of trips to Egypt and Dada, a lot of studying and taking people on tours. And I've been so fortunate myself to be on a couple of your tours. So it seems like you have gravitated towards Egypt. But I also know that you have a degree or about East Asian studies or from university. So you could have taken that road. You could have gone more east than kind of Middle East. You think it's random that it's Egypt that has kind of been in your heart for 15, 20 years? Or could it have been also or guiding tours to the east?
Well, I think a few things. I don't know that I could have ever really understood anything much about Egyptian cosmology or philosophy or how they live, if I hadn't learned something about, for example, the perspective of Buddhism. I had to get a little bit out of the conditioning of my Western mind to be able to play in a bigger field of experience. And Buddhism taught me a lot about that, was very helpful. And I still use a lot of the things I learned from that tradition. At the same time, I felt, you know what, a lot of people have already explored that path. There are a lot of good books out there about Buddhism. There's a lot of good books about the history of Hinduism and the great teachings of India and Taoism in China. That's very well covered. But not many people know about Egypt, and they even hear false things about Egypt. They're just completely wrong. So I thought, well, wouldn't it be good to sort of illuminate and open up this great world teaching, which in my view stands behind its or earlier than all of the Western religions of Judaism, Christianity, Islam, but also of our Greek based philosophy and science. The Egyptians were doing all this before any of those other cultures. And of course, as being young cultures, they learned from the older culture. So it becomes very important, but also, you know, a personal reason is that, you know, Mr. Gurdjieff, in talking about the energy behind the Enneagram, which he called the fourth way, he said that the part of the mission is that the wisdom of the East must come into balance and blend with the creative energy of the West. Now, that very interesting statement. He said, if that doesn't happen, our civilization will go backwards. It will regress. We see evidence of that now. We've never been closer to really the kind of world that we all hope for, and we seem ready to just wreck it. So I felt that we could not ever have that happen if we don't know the Western tradition, if we only know the outside of it. There are profound teachings in Judaism, in Christianity, and in Islam, but most people don't know them. They know the external expressions, which are, have their place, and there's a reason they're there. But there is this deeper teaching in all of them that known by very few people. It went secret pretty early on. And it all leads you back to Egypt. And Egypt, you can see the earliest stirrings of this particular way of looking at reality. I think in a certain way, one of my friends and mentors, Hamid Ali, A.H. Almas, he used to say that the Eastern traditions tell us more about the ultimate nature of reality. They're an experiential understanding of what is the ground of existence. And whether you're talking about Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, they're talking about that. Western religion, and of course, those traditions focus on, and if you know that, how do you live? You know, for example, if you become a Buddhist monk, the precepts of Buddhism are very important. On the other side, the Western view is more about how do we live in a way that's harmonious with the deeper purpose of humanity, with the divine order, however you want to think of it, and more focused on that, on right living. And all of those traditions have explorations of the ground of reality. So they kind of balance each other. But as I said, we can't have that marriage if we don't know the inner teaching. It's encouraging to me. I know a lot of people who are Muslim, for example, and many of them are my friends who will be at the conference in Cairo, who are really getting interested in Sufism and the real inner teachings of Islam. Christians, too, really wanting to get beyond just, you know, go to church and sing songs. Fine. But there's a deeper message to Christianity. Jews learning about the Kabbalistic traditions and the mystical side of their religion. There's been a growing interest of that, especially in young people, and the Enneagram is part of that. Where it gets out of religion as a club that you join and more into a guidance for remembering your inner life and how to live in the world while staying connected with what your heart loves, what is the deeper truth.
Mm-hmm.
It's been very moving doing some of these presentations in Egypt over the year at the IEA. I mean, the first time I did, and I really started to show my understanding of the real meaning of ancient Egypt and how it goes into Islam and Christianity and Judaism. And people were crying, you know. I think one of the reasons I show people about Egypt is that we people who happen to grow up in Western cultures have forgotten the legacy of our civilization. And to remember that is to restore a kind of root system. You know, if we're going to flower and grow, you need roots, right? If you don't know what they are, that's kind of a problem. Or if your idea of them is distorted, that's going to be a bit of a problem. So I don't tell people it's this, it's that. I show them the mysteries. I show them what we don't know. I show them how sometimes both religious people and scholars will just make some stuff up and then we decide that that's the truth. But that there is, it's much more interesting and helpful to live into the questions and to see these mysteries for ourselves and see what they bring to our understanding and to our heart.
I now have a question where you have to pick from A, B, or C.
Oh, boy. Here we go.
Oh, boy. Imagine that you have to make this choice. That's kind of the setting here. You have to make this choice and work with people that have a very particular focus. So you will be invited or to invest your wisdom and your generosity in A or in B or in C. a group of people that for 3 years will dedicate themselves to find ways to bring the Enneagram to young adults. That's the A. Or you are supporting a group of people that will support relationship, personal relationship in thriving using the Enneagram. Or C, leaders of organizations and businesses to kind of be more masterful in the way that they act. And you cannot mix them. You have to kind of pour your energy and your wisdom and your care in one of these hypothetical direction. What is most appealing to you, and where do you think you are connected the most, and where would it benefit the world the most, if you should pick from A, B, or C?
Very interesting question, Fleming. I think part of it isn't only what I like, it's also what I'm good at. And, you know, you work long enough and you have a few years on you, you start to know that you do some things better than others. All of those are very interesting and all of them are worthy of attention. But sometimes we just have to say, you know what, someone else will do that better than me. So I would pick probably A. I've always enjoyed working with younger people and being a good example for them and being a safe place for them and helping them explore these things. But I would just add to it, part of that work would be, you know, I know I'm just one person and I don't know how much more time I get on planet Earth. None of us knows that. But I would also, in tandem with helping younger people myself, be training some people besides me who could also help the next generation. That interests me because it's important that this go on. You know, somehow these teachings got to us through many centuries. You know, somebody carried that light. It's like the Olympics, you know, the torch bearer. Somebody carried that and got it to us. And I want to make sure it gets carried on into the future through the next generation. So young people understanding it, very important. Also, I just think young people are going to face some challenges in the world that are new, that there aren't previous solutions for. They're going to have to be very creative. They're going to have to really know how to access these deeper resources, which is what the Enneagram teaches us. And so to train some of them in a sense so that they can become those kind of leaders like Choice C, that they can become people who can help navigate the future challenges, that is very moving to me. And I think it's part of the larger purpose of the Enneagram itself.
Thank you. I have a few last questions about the future here. And one of them would be, if you were the one making the decision where a bunch of scientists should go and do some studies about the Enneagram, in what direction will you direct them?
Well, I think there's a lot of elements to it. But one of them is, of course, the neurobiology of it. And I'm going to be having a conversation with Dan Siegel soon, who's one of the prominent voices in helping people understand neurobiology and personality and so forth. And he worked for quite a while with my colleague, David Daniels, who also is sadly no longer with us. But he's writing a book now about the Enneagram from the point of view of neurobiology. So that's one big element. I mean, depends what we mean by science. There are, you know, psychological and sociological implications. In terms of hard science, I think on the one hand, it's understanding, are there biological predilections for these types? Could be. I wouldn't be surprised. And if so, what are they? What are the mechanisms? That has a lot of implications for medication and things like that. But I think also it from the kind of physics end of the pool, it is an invitation to a deeper understanding of the mechanisms of consciousness itself. And there are some, you know, very famous physicists, Roger Penrose comes to mind, who've tried to come up with some understanding or model for how consciousness is part of the physical universe. And just thinking of it as a side effect of biology, I think is partially true, but very limited view. There's more to it than that. But it's going to take another kind of understanding to really open that frontier. You know, when Isaac Newton was trying to understand physics, the mathematics and the method of describing that didn't exist. So he had to create it. He created calculus and mathematical models to be able to describe what he was observing. And in a similar way, if we're going to get any further with the understanding of consciousness, we're going to have to create a new calculus, another way of a language, a way of modeling it that works with that level of reality.
Thanks. Let's say you have a wish for the Enneagram in the future. Let's say you have a wish for people are getting engaged with the Enneagram. Let's say you have a wish for how the world could look like if we benefited from the presence and self-awareness from the Enneagram. What would that wish be?
Suddenly, I'm just remembering some things that Don Riso used to say. I think the gift of the Enneagram is self-awareness. And from that self-awareness, a greater capacity to be aware of others, to meet others where they are, to not project our fears and anger and things onto other people, not to idealize them either, but to learn to have more real presence-based encounters, real relationship within ourselves and with other people, and maybe with our pets too, you know. Animals can be very interesting. But I think, we need another way of meeting other than merging around ideas that usually are ideas about being against somebody else. We need another way of coming together that's not some sort of exclusive social gathering, right? We need a way of feeling the network of our humanity. And I think if we do that, we start to feel more of what I might call an organic common purpose. I believe, from my experiences, that we human beings have objective purposes. And part of the malaise and the tragedy of modern civilization is we've lost the sense of that. This really came out during COVID, where the usual distractions were removed from us and we're suddenly facing this existential void that most of us are living in. And a lot of people really had a lot of trouble as a result of that. They spiraled into all kinds of problems. And we don't, as a society yet, have any kind of conversation of restoring our sense of place in the world, in the cosmos. That's what the ancient Egyptians had over us. The most common workers in Egypt had that sense. When you go into the tomb of just the common people, you see they're celebrating their life and the way they lived and their place in the universe. We don't have that. And so we're all kind of alone and isolated and disconnected. I think the Enneagram, in bringing in this presence-based self-awareness, starts to reconnect us with the capacity to feel our place in the universe and to meet each other with common purpose around fulfilling our place in the universe. And I think that was the real mission behind our great spiritual traditions too. Just personality took over, as it usually does.
The organic common purpose that is here, we just have to kind of wake up to see it.
Yeah, or feel it. It isn't like it. You get the whole thing, like, here is the mission. It's not a mission statement. It's not really like that. It's more like it comes into you through your receptivity in your heart and flashes of ideas and realizations and sometimes just feeling, I know it's this way. I know this is the direction needed. I know I need to talk to that person. You know, it comes to us like that. Very intuitive in a sense. But I say that also, you know, it's intuitive and it brings us to another level of rationality. Not rationality as some sort of defense against our feelings, but rationality is the ability to really think through the challenges and to find living solutions. That's an extraordinary thing.
Thank you a lot for taking your time to do this interview. Thank you, Ross.
Thank you so much, Fleming. It was a lot of fun.
Tak fordi du lyttede med, og tjek show notes, hvis du vil med på næste Enneagram-kursus Basic. Her lærer du alt om typerne, og det er en rigtig god start til din rejse med Enneagrammet.